You're listening to Voyager, a Vaughn Group podcast where we sit down with innovators, artists, and visionaries from a variety of industries and dig into their journeys. I'm Travis Vaughn, and today I'm with Brooke Hemphill. Brooke is the Senior Vice President of Research with Barna Group, and she's the Chief Growth Officer with True Motivate. Brooke is a graduate of Cornell University, and today we'll talk about her journey from Cornell to Barna, how to go about market research, and what exactly is True Motivate. We'll also talk briefly about her new podcast. So thanks for joining us today. Sit back, relax, enjoy the podcast. Brooke Hemphill is on the podcast today. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Good. So what are you doing these days?
Oh, wow.
Like, where is most of your creative energy being poured into?
Yeah. So it's a fascinating time to be in research, because especially social research, because there's a few things going on in the world.
Just a few things.
Just a few things. So one of the things that I love about doing research is I am obsessed with demography. In fact, when I was in college, I used to read American Demographics, which is a magazine all about stats of people,
okay.
People types.
Okay.
So right now there's this confluence of demographics and political ideologies and cultures of different areas. And we've got all sorts of focus around our demographics, like race and gender and where we live and our you know, affiliations, right? And so all those are merging together, because this year has just kind of brought them, the past year has kind of brought all that to light. So a lot of my time that I get to spend now is doing research on certain topics, but then plugging in, how does that fit with all these other trends that are happening more broadly in the US and globally, and technology tying all that together? Like, it's just fascinating to see the overlap. And so most of my time is spent doing research, but then looking at that research and interpreting it through the lens of what's happening in various social areas of the world.
Like, what? So when you wake up in the morning, where do you get your news? Since you're a researcher, a demographer, where are you starting with?
Okay, so New York Times is my favorite because they have a whole data visualization department.
Okay.
They're amazing. They crunch data and then they visualize it in ways that I just get excited about.
Okay.
So
that makes total sense.
I love the infographics and I like the stories that they do. It's a mix of, you know, geopolitical stories and then really personal things, which I think that's helpful to have context to trends. So I like New York Times for a lot of just the big stories.
Right.
I read The Economist pretty regularly. Even my 13-year-old daughter now reads The Economist with us, which
okay.
is, that's the kind of family we are. So that's the core of my what's happening in the world right now kind of news. And then, honestly, I do a ton of my just seeing what's going on with Instagram. And so I will find different people or groups that I'm following. And what I'm looking for there is the leading edge of the trends. Because when you do research, you realize everything's a bell curve.
Right.
And so what you see in averages is the bulk of the bell curve. But that's not the trend. The trend is at the front end, and that's like 3% of the population that's in that space. So what you're looking for on social media is the leading end of what you're beginning to see more of. And then you go, oh, that's something I want to learn more about. Or there's something happening there. We better go research that.
So I want to talk more about that. But I want to first start with, where did you go to school? I mean, how did you end up in this career field?
Oh my goodness. In? My career path is so confusing to most people.
Because you've done a few things and you're actually doing like two or three things right now.
Yeah. So I'll do the quick version of my resume. If you look at my resume, it'll look like a drunk driver was on it.
It doesn't look that bad. I checked LinkedIn before.
It pieces together, but it didn't make sense at the time. So I started at age 8 being like, I love restaurants and events, and I want to do that. And by age 13, I was convinced I was going to go to the hotel school at Cornell, and I was going to have an event company. And I still love doing that and do that in my personal time. Just decided not to make a career out of it.
Okay.
reason being that I get to Cornell and two things happen. One is that I actually did fall in love with marketing and some of the data like American demographics. And I realized that to me was even more interesting than the grind. That was the other part. I realized the grind of the hospitality industry. I love it, but it's really hard. And it takes a toll on your personal life. And I was just counting the cost of that and thinking, you know what? What if I focus on marketing instead? And so personal decisions came into play there as well. Of course, my husband graduated before me and So I kind of was following a little bit of where he was going. But
did you guys meet at Cornell?
We met at Cornell. Okay. He's a hotelie. That's what we call ourselves,
right.
Hotelies.
Right.
And he has been in the hotel business for over 20 years.
Right.
And so we decided one of us should still do this. And he, of course, I mean, loves it. So I kind of live vicariously through him to a great degree. But I then said, I'm going to focus on marketing. And so I started out doing public relations because I do enjoy writing. And so I did a ton of writing for about 3 years. And it was super fun because when I graduated, it was the dot-com boom of the late 90s. And it was like everything was new. And so it was just a fantastic time to be in Los Angeles writing about technology and services around those. But then I also, one of the client types I served was real estate. And I started writing a lot of research or releases about some of the ways that they were rethinking the real estate model. So in the dot-com era, you had to think about shipping packages and shipping goods, right? So think Amazon. Basically, we've got pallets of stuff. And if you look at a warehouse is measured on square footage. But if you're thinking pallets, you're thinking, how high can I stack them? So you actually need to be thinking about cubic footages. And so I was working with some real estate clients who were rethinking the model of industrial real estate because of the dot-com boom. And I got super excited about calculating cubic square footages. And I was
Which
like,
everybody does.
I mean, my colleagues were like, what is up with you in these numbers? And so I was writing these articles about like, this is going to revolutionize real estate. And they were kind of like, I mean, okay, if you want to look at the numbers, you can do that.
Oh my goodness.
So I said, you know, I'd love to use that side of my brain because I'm just not using the number side of my brain. And so I had this kind of realization at that moment that I was actually a nerd. And I didn't know that I was a nerd.
Did you know that you were a nerd at 8?
No. No, because I love parties and people and writing. Okay. And so I use that creative side of my brain so much more, even though I did take calculus and physics and all those classes.
But you said 8 years old. That's kind of when you figured out the whole restaurant, hotel.
Yes.
What were you doing? Like, how do you even remember that?
I was having parties and inviting people, like family members first and then neighbors. And I would create menus and I would write them up.
Okay.
I was pretty entrepreneurial. Okay. And my mom was like, you're going to need to do something with this.
Wow.
So we would draw pictures of what my first restaurant would look like or what my catering business branding would be at age 9.
At
I knew my
nine.
Branding.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. So I love the idea of starting companies or businesses and helping them establish themselves, which will show up in my story a little later. But I didn't know I was a nerd. I thought I was really creative. So that was an aha moment for me.
Wow. Okay. So Cornell to Barna. I want to talk a lot about what you're doing with Barna, what you've been doing with Barna. But let's walk me through, how did you get from Cornell to where you are today?
So at that moment when I was doing PR, and some of my work that I did for PR, real estate is related to hospitality, right? So there was a bridge.
Right.
It connected. But then I said, you know, I love this number thing. What can I do that brings marketing together with numbers? And that's market research. And so I did some looking around and some networking. We were about to move anyway. So I was looking for jobs in the market research space, found a company in Boston that was pretty heady market research, like really stats heavy. They did a lot of statistical modeling. And this was at the beginning of online surveys when there was no such thing as online surveys. SurveyMonkey didn't exist. So they were programming surveys from scratch.
So what year is this?
This was 2001.
Okay.
And normally, they were still using a lot of like phone or like paper surveys that you would code it and you would put it through the Scantron machine.
Right.
And they were beginning to pioneer online surveys. And I was like, well, this could be really cool. So I jumped into market research and again, stats heavy. I learned what ones and zeros are. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is a whole other language. I love this. So I kind of went like really deep into the rabbit hole. Coincidentally, the time that I started was about 3 weeks before 9/11. And in Boston, 9/11 hit pretty hard. In fact, a lot of our clients were in New York. One of my clients was in the building on the phone with me when the plane hit. And we were launching a survey that morning, so I was there early in the morning.
Yeah.
And he was like, I see a plane out the window. Like something's
He's on the phone with you.
On the phone with me.
Oh my gosh.
He's like, I'm going to need to go. And then we didn't hear from him for 3 days. And we're like, I think he made it out okay. But like, so all of our clients were right there in the middle of this. So that was a wild way to get into,
into
that space. what I jumped into at that point was fascinating that it was a time of confusion. And so actually, even though everything stopped for a little while, for about 2 months, then there was a flurry of activity. Like people wanted to do lots of research and figure out what was going on. Which anytime there's a big shift in the economy or in the marketplace, research becomes really important because it's how you make a decision, right? I don't know what's happening, but let's see if we can figure it out by doing some research. So we were crazy busy. So I was learning statistics. I'd taken some stats courses, but I was learning how to program surveys, reading ones and zeros and coding, and how to read, you know, data tables that are just like ribbons of numbers.
Oh, yeah. Like the Matrix.
It was the Matrix. And I was like, this is actually pretty cool. I just didn't know what it was before.
Yeah.
So those numbers really are real. It looks like that if you're reading programming. And I was like, I think I really like this. And again, I didn't know I was a nerd, but I am. But what I love was putting those two things together, which was the story side of PR and the number side of market research, and saying, what is the story coming out of these numbers? Mm-hmm. And so that's what I was always looking for, is what does this tell us about a situation or people or what's happening here or what that means about the future? So that to me was like, this is the perfect intersection of the creative side and the analytical side, and how do we make use of that?
Yeah, so you already dove into kind of one of our topics today, talking about market research. So give me the really nerdy definition of market research. You've already been talking about it. And then the layman's definition of market research.
Yeah.
For those that are listening.
So the nerdy version is that we're looking at data, observable data about a population that tells us something about that population. So there's actually a couple different types of research. So there's social science research, which I would say is different than market research. So social science will say, let's look at a huge population and let's try to uncover truths about what's going on.
Right.
Market research says, let's not spend 10 years. Let's spend a couple of months. Let's define a market.
Okay.
Right? So that might be a category, an industry. It might be a geographical area, a customer segment, and let's learn what we need to know about them that helps inform our business strategy. So it's a focused version of social science research.
Okay.
So we use all the same statistical tools, but we use them differently and we connect a lot more dots. So social science will absolutely draw hard lines between everything and say, okay, this is something that we've proven to be true. And market research works much more on hypotheses and inference. And so you get just enough data to put the puzzle together to say, okay, this is enough. Like, we're 90% confidence in this and we're going to run with it, because to be 100% confidence would take us 2 more years and we'd miss the boat.
Okay.
Like, we need to use this for decision-making purposes.
Pause right there for a second. You said you're using some tools. So 2 or 3 tools that you're using back then and then today.
Oh, gosh.
Or just today.
Yeah, no. So back then, SPSS is what people would be familiar with if they took classes in college.
Right.
We also used a variety of different other programming languages, SAS and a few others. Now there's amazing new tools. I mean, those are like really cranky, old, slow, not very easy to use tools. You know, now there's like R, which I'm not even capable in, but you don't need to be to do the market research, honestly. There's programs for that. So you just have your programs that kind of run your crosstabs. But, you know, we would literally crunch the data. We'd program a survey, run the data in SAS, and you're literally like setting up card columns. And yeah, I'm drawing a grid with my hands, but
yes.
Card columns where you're putting the numbers in columns and rows to organize the data to be able to average it out or run a mean or standard deviation, that sort of thing. So you're using statistics through different applications. And now we have some amazing tools that they model that data and they figure out the relationships between different data. So there's all sorts of new things that I wouldn't know how to do from scratch right now, but I work with smart people who do that.
Right. So who were some of your clients back early 2000s?
The two categories I was working in then were financial services. So American Express was my client at the World Trade Center. And like credit card companies and those sorts of things. And banks. And then also pharmaceuticals. And I actually ended up doing a lot more work in pharmaceuticals in the end. I have no background in that. As you heard, I studied hotel industry. Like literally, I have a business degree that was specialized.
I'm piecing together what's going on here, but no, keep going.
So I was like, I'm going to need to learn some biology. But one of the things that I love about research is I get to learn every day. So part of my job is learning new things. And so learning a new category wasn't much different than learning a new skill set. So I had to quickly learn different therapy areas. So for example, the very first one, this was so awesome that I was working on this. The very first one I was working on was in mental health. And we were testing an ad campaign for a mental health drug that had a new indication. And that indication was post-traumatic stress disorder. So previously it might've been used for anxiety or depression. And now they had an indication that said, if you have a patient with post-traumatic stress disorder, we have these clinical trials that show that this is effective.
Right.
And so what you're doing is trying to communicate to potential patients, like people who are suffering from this, that, hey, there's actually something that can help you. Have you talked to your doctor about these things that you're experiencing? And so that's a really tricky category to advertise for because you have to break through people's mental barriers that they've created or the normalization that they've given the things, the symptoms they're experiencing. And so we were literally testing what are the ways for someone who actually has post-traumatic stress disorder, who probably doesn't know that they do, to go at least talk to their doctor about this thing.
Right.
Whether or not they ask for this drug, like first step is you need to go talk to a doctor. And so can you imagine testing a drug for PTSD in New York when 9/11 has just happened?
Wow.
And that's what we were doing.
Wow.
And we were already doing that testing before 9/11. And so then it was all credit to the pharmaceutical companies. They were like, this is going to look like we're trying to take advantage of people. We think we shouldn't do this right now. And so we did some research about it. And the people in New York were like, please, please do this.
Right.
Like there are people who are struggling and they need to know that actually they are experiencing post-traumatic stress and they need to go talk to their doctor because this is horrific. So it was an incredible opportunity to be able to. So some of the research I do is numbers. That part of the research was actually focus groups and one-on-one interviews with people.
Right.
So a lot of my work too was qualitative and that was where we gleaned that insight of like, oh, this is something that we should pursue.
So that, what you were doing then seems to really play into what you're doing now with research,
mm-hmm.
now that I'm kind of tracking the story together here. So you're with Barna today.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference? The kind of research you're doing with Barna, I mean, it's a completely different sort of organization
yes.
than what you worked with. But let's start with how did you get to Barna and then how is the research different?
Yeah. So got to Barna because over the course of being in market research and working with a lot of pharmaceutical companies, I was traveling a ton. So the focus group research that I described would be like, you started Monday, you do 10 hours, and then you meet with the client the next day, and then you go to Chicago and you do 10 hours, and then you go to LA and you do 10 hours, and then you come home. So you are doing these insane weeks and traveling like nonstop. And so when I had my second child, I was like, the week that my husband had to go to London and I was supposed to go to Istanbul and Rome that week.
Wow.
We were like, you know, maybe this isn't working really well.
Were you guys still in Boston at the time?
No, we were actually in Atlanta by then. We had
okay.
lived in London for a while.
Okay.
So after, we were just in Boston for a couple of years. My husband got a job in London and
I forgot about that.
Yeah. So that was really cool. We were there for 3 years, loved it. And then they transferred him to the Atlanta office
okay.
of his company. So during that time, I continued to work for my same Boston company as their European coordinator. So I would go to all the countries in Europe and do research, either, you know, data research or focus groups and working with translators and all that. So when I came back, I was still like the European healthcare system expert for the company. And so I was being like shuttled off to, in my second pregnancy, I was literally going to Amsterdam once a month. And that was incredibly hard.
Wow, Brooke.
Like, no, you know what? I'm going to stop for a little while.
Wow.
So the transition was I stopped working and they had been so accommodating and so helpful. But I was like, I just need a break. This is just a lot. So I stopped working for a couple of years, about 2 years. But I don't sit still very well. So I was doing lots of pro bono work and helping some nonprofits and churches that I was involved with to do research. Which was super fun. And that's how I met Barna.
Okay.
So I did not know there was such thing as like an industry around church, but there is in a way. There's all these services that serve churches.
Right.
And Barna's one of those. And so I found Barna through happenstance with the ministry I was working with, or a client that I was serving. And actually it was quite funny because I was so used to doing segmentations, which is a model of understanding your customers and grouping them in different ways so that you can kind of talk to them in a way that's more relevant to them. Mm-hmm. I'd done so many of those in my work that I was working with this pro bono client, and I was like, man, if we could just get some data, then I could segment your audience for you and help you to know like how to focus in on different maybe demographic groups or people at different phases of their life to kind of better connect with them. And so they called up Barna and they were like, hey, we have this board member whose wife was wondering if you could just give her some data to play with. And David Gitteman was like, no. Okay. So I went and found some similar data that I was interested in on the Pew Research site, which, note to listeners, you can download all the data sets on the Pew Research site and you can play with them. Oh my gosh, it's such an incredible resource. So I created a segmentation based on something that they had and shared it at this meeting, and Barna was there and they were like, what, who are you? What are you doing? So I was like, oh, there's people who do research with ministries. I didn't know about that. And they were like, oh, there's people who do research who care about ministries and who actually, you know, would be willing to work in that space. And so thus I joined Barna. And it was great because I suddenly was working with all these nonprofits, mm-hmm. people doing really awesome work. And Barna does two kinds of work. We're either helping them figure out how to do their work more effectively and how to get the word out about their work, or, and so that's just their proprietary thing, or right. we're doing these published studies, which right. is what most people know Barna for.
Right.
And so that is a lot of the focus of, you know, what the social research is. It's a little different than market research. It's broader social research. It's trend tracking and things like that that most people know Barna for.
So you've got this whole industry around the church, mm-hmm. a faith-based population. So who would be like you don't have to name any names, but who would like be the type of ideal client for Barna?
So we do work with some churches, but actually most of who we work with are organizations that serve churches.
Okay.
And so they might provide like content resources for them, or they might be doing work, like let's say they're doing work in other countries and churches want to support that. So it's the things that where the cross section of those two groups are. So nonprofits and churches, there's a cross section of the type of work that they're both interested in.
Okay. So let's take a project. So a client comes to you, I want to do XYZ. What's the first thing you do? Just walk me through. You mm-hmm. can keep it generic. You don't have to name anything, but just walk me through the process of working with a client.
Sure. I will actually name one because I think it's very interesting. So we worked with a client to produce a study on Gen Z. And we've actually done two now that we've published that involved a lot of research. So the first thing we did is we say, well, what are the questions we have? And people get a little nervous because they're like, I don't know what questions I'm going to put in the survey. Like, no. What are the big picture, like 30,000 foot questions you have or hypotheses that you have that you want to learn more about? So we kind of whiteboard those and get those out on the table. And then from there, we refine it and say, okay, how are we going to answer those questions? So some of them will say, you know, these are exploratory and we actually need to do some of those interviews and focus groups to find the answers to that, or at least give us some clues. And then once we have some more clues, then it's like, these are the ones we need to do survey research for. And for the Gen Z study, it was like, okay, well, we can go ask teenagers, because at that time, right. Gen Z was just hitting 18, 19, 20. So we could go ask them, but they're like still in formation as a generation. Right. Like they're not baked yet.
Right.
Their brains are still processing. So we probably want to talk to other people who know about them as well. So then we did surveys with parents of teens, and then we did surveys with mentors of teens. And then we did some expert interviews with like educators or, you know, people who provide resources about teens and things like that. So we kind of mesh all of that together and synthesize this qualitative data, this survey research, and we're beginning to formulate some big themes. What are the big themes that we're seeing over and over keep coming up in here? So Gen Z is a great one because like it was really quickly obvious. We kind of knew going in, technology had really changed their lives compared right. to the previous generations. Like it was native to them. They had grown up with it. And so they were truly shaped. Their brains are actually shaped by technology.
Oh, no doubt.
So, okay, what does that mean, right? So we explored their sense of identity. That was a theme that kept coming up a lot.
They're essentially cyborgs.
It's right? A little bit like that. Most of their brain is on that device, whatever that device is, right? And they're comfortable with that. Yeah. Like, I don't need to learn facts because they're on Google. So I actually know lots of things because they're all on that device there, right?
Right.
They have a very high sense of their education level because of that, or knowledge level because of that. It also revealed some mental health questions, like the anxiety and depression they were experiencing was real. This is when Jean Twenge's book, iGen, came out, and it was such a good insight. So we were doing our research at the same time. She had just published longitudinal data that she'd been studying about behaviors, normal teenage behaviors that had drastically shifted since the advent of the iPhone. And so we were like, okay, there's a whole lot of mental health issue to deal with in the space. And then there was this reality of like, the way that they process cognitively appears to be different. Their worldview is kind of different. And so we were able to look at these questions we'd asked in surveys, but then you piece together this puzzle of like, we see these big themes emerging, and these are the things that are important that colleges are going to need to know, employers are going to need to know, parents are still going to need to know. Anyone who's mentoring them needs to understand this about them, because you can't just apply, oh, this was my experience when I was their age, and think that it's going to be the same. It's a completely different world that they've grown up in.
So talk about some of the particulars of going about the research. Like, how many interviews are you doing with individuals? Mm-hmm. How many focus groups are you pulling together? How are you pulling those focus groups together? What other kind of primary research means are you using?
Yeah, good. So you don't need a ton of qualitative research to begin to form hypotheses, because what you're trying to do is just make sure you've gotten all the ideas onto the page, right? So we will often do between 2 and 4 or 5 focus groups, depending on how much diversity there is within our group.
And how do you pull them together? Or is this giving away the
secret
sauce?
No. I mean, there's agencies that recruit, basically, right, who have databases. So they tend to be very local. They'll have a local listing, and they will start calling or emailing or whatever and saying, hey, we have someone who'd like to do a focus group. Would you come in and do that? And they get paid a small amount to come in and just talk to someone or whatever. When I was in commercial side of things, I mean, focus groups were super fun. And so we'd have people come in and we would look at advertising together, or there would be taste test focus groups where you're literally trying out different foods. So all sorts of stuff. And people actually enjoy it because they're like, I don't know what this is going to be. Let's see. So we get those sort of people who are like, I'm so excited to be here because I don't know what you're going to ask me.
Right.
There's companies that kind of recruit and bring them in. And they are usually in person, although increasingly you can do a virtual focus group.
Sure.
And now, of course, with COVID, really, that's all that you're doing for the most part. And people are comfortable gathering on Zoom and talking with perfect strangers. And so the person moderating the focus group has to be really adept at kind of building rapport quickly, helping people feel comfortable.
Do you guys outsource that, or do you do it all in-house?
We do that part in-house because it really, being a good moderator, a lot of it depends on having enough of the subject matter or knowledge of the audience to be able to hear something and go, oh, that's something real. I'm going to follow that thread and be adept to jump topics to kind of find the interesting tidbits in what they're saying.
So with research, you know, you see these research projects that say, well, things are trending this way, or we see this coming. And then you're thinking to yourself, well, they never called me. Nobody asked me about this.
Okay.
How many people are you asking to be able to say, okay, we see a trend going in this direction?
I would not base a trend on qualitative. It would only be based on a survey.
Okay.
So it kind of depends, is always the answer with statistics. Depends on how big of a group and how diverse a group you're trying to represent. But in theory, you could survey 2,000 people in the United States, and if you get the right mix, because we're always watching to match demographics and stuff to make sure it's representative. If you get the right mix, you can actually predict a trend within 2 or 3 percentage points of the entire US.
Okay.
So 2,000 people can represent 300 million
people. And what's the magic behind 2,000 people?
So what you get
or
is...
Or whatever number you're going to use.
It depends, again, on how big of a sample you're trying to represent. But it's the law of diminishing returns. So if you survey 100 people, you might see a certain amount of variance in their answers. And then you go to 500 people and you're seeing, okay, we've accounted for most of it, so the variance reduces. And then when you get to 2,000, like each additional person you add doesn't change your average that much.
Right.
If you get to 5,000, each additional person you add doesn't change the data at all. And so it's a law of diminishing returns of we are, and we call it a confidence interval, we are 90 or 95% confident that we are actually representing reality based on this sample, the statistical sample. And so the science for that was developed. This is so cool. In the 60s, there's a statistician I used to work with who grew up in the 60s, like coding this
stuff. Some people think this is cool, Brooke. Not everyone thinks this is cool.
No, this is the story. The story is cool. Okay. So this
I think it's
lovely
cool.
Old statistician from the 60s was like, do you know how this happened? Do you remember in the 60s, if you remember, or maybe the 70s, even 80s, when you would fly somewhere, you would get a paper ticket. And it would be, I don't know, Travis, if you remember this, it would be like handwritten and there'd be these red copies. And
I don't remember. I'm trying to think.
I know you're older than me.
I'm not that old though. Wait, I'm trying to
maybe
think.
I've just seen it in textbooks.
I remember the paper copies, but I don't remember the handwritten
stuff. So if you went internationally, let's say that.
Okay.
If you went internationally, there were these multiple copies below that were using this red ink that would copy your ticket multiple times. So there'd be like 8 copies of your ticket. The reason was you would fly Delta from Atlanta to JFK. Then you would get on British Airways, and British Airways would fly you to the UK. And then you would get on Air France, and Air France would fly you to Paris, right? So they had to transfer the amount of money that you had paid Delta, some portion to each of those airlines to be able to know or to be able to kind of acquire their revenue, right? So they got a paper copy of all those tickets to say, okay, Delta, you owe British Airways this much for this ticket and this much for that ticket. So they're collecting hundreds of thousands of tickets from every different of the like hundreds of airline carriers at the time, right? Because it was very fragmented. And they would have to do all the accounting for that. They would have to literally add them up. And it was costing them more than they were actually getting to account for what they were owing other airlines and they were owed by other airlines. So what they did in the 60s or late 60s was take a sample. They would randomly mix them up. Let's take out a sample of 100 of these. And they ran a test and they said, if we calculate the money that we owe everybody based on these 100, and then we actually do the entire stack, the 100 gets so close that it's worth it to us. And this is the premise behind market research. It's close enough that it's not worth the money to be exact. We're going to be 90 to 95% within that range of accuracy for far less money because we haven't paid all these accountants to actually calculate every single ticket. So that's how statistics was kind of born and brought into the norm of just making better decisions in a more cost-effective way.
Right.
By taking a sample that is representative of a whole.
Right. No, that makes sense. So I know we're doing a deep dive on
the
how-to of research. So how do you get picked to be one of the 2,000 that gets interviewed or gets surveyed?
It is so random.
But for those that don't know, how do you go about that?
It could be a lot of things. So it used to be you would just go through the phone book and randomly pick a number and call someone. But people don't really have landlines anymore, so that doesn't happen.
Were you actually doing that at some point?
I would hire people who did that.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't have to call anyone on the phone, thank the Lord. That would have been really hard to try to convince someone to take a survey. Those people are saints.
That would never happen today.
Yeah. No, you don't, because you don't pick up the phone.
No one answers the phone.
You don't pick up the phone. So they don't do that so much anymore. It's occasional, but really rare. Which is why, by the way, political polling is so poor right now, because it used to be a much better method. Now you can't be sure that you're representing the whole population. Right. So other options would be you could go to a mall and see who walks by and you could randomly pick every 10th person. That's actually called a mall intercept. You can look at a zip code map and you can randomly pick households and mail them a survey. And you make sure demographically you're representing the population.
Did you ever do a mall intercept?
I did one time.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
To test out.
Was that fun?
Brand. I was testing branding for a particular soft drink beverage. And it was super cool, actually, because it was like, I have this room over here. Do you want to come in and see what I've got in the room?
Okay.
It was hilarious.
That is hilarious.
And I had like tons of soda cans in the room. And I wanted to ask them about the branding. It was really fun. And in other countries, they would do that with a van. And they would have a van and be like, do you want to come in the van and like get the soft
Okay. Drink? That would never happen today. Or does it still happen today?
Yeah, no, not in that way, but kind of. It does happen in other countries that way. To be fair, one of my vans in one of our countries got stolen, and so we had to make sure everyone was okay and safe.
Right.
That is a really frightening concept, but that's how we do it. Okay, so other ways. And so now, because you can't just randomly find people, what happens is you troll the internet for these people.
Okay.
And so sometimes people will see ads pop up if they're on a site that says, right. Hey, would you, you know, take a survey? And then there's others, usually loyalty programs. So think if I'm getting points for my Domino's pizza, it's like, hey, do you want to join our loyalty program? Now we've got your information. Okay, so the loyalty program says, hey, do you want to earn extra money or extra, you know, coupons for Domino's pizza by answering a survey occasionally? And people are like, yeah, okay, I'll do that. So you get in this massive database. And there's all these companies that sell what's called sample.
Right.
Sample is people. It's contact information for people. And you're like, okay, I need to do a survey of 2,000 people. I need a sample of 200,000 people to be able to get enough people to respond to my survey. And so then you kind of reach out to them and connect with them. It's also called a panel. If you kind of pre-agree to take surveys and you're like, okay, yeah, when I get an email from Rakuten, I know that they're asking me about surveys.
So other tools. So we've talked surveys, we've talked focus groups, other tools that you're that Barna uses.
I mean, a lot of it is looking at secondary data as well. And secondary data just means publicly available data.
Right.
So we triangulate with other sources.
So
we,
what are some places people can go for public
research? Pew is one of our favorites. They've got data on technology that's fantastic, communications, adoption, things like that, on different business industries. They've got just general demographic trends that are fascinating. And it's all just these publicly available data sets that go back decades, and they're awesome. They're awesome for tracking. So that's a good one. Gallup has some sources, but then like any U.S. government entity, right? So the Census Bureau, all of the data, they've got all these different types of surveys they do. You can get health data, healthcare data. You can get economic data, jobs, businesses. You can get for nonprofits, you can look at, you know, who's donated, like what are the sources of foundations and who they're, what they're giving to, and then how much people are receiving as donations. So all that sort of stuff has to get reported, you know, for legal purposes. And that's all publicly available.
So do you guys just have like an office party whenever like the census data stuff comes out? I mean, that's like this month or next month,
right? We're waiting on 2020. I know. It was such a slog to collect data in 2020.
So when is it supposed to come out? It's like mid-April, right?
I don't believe that's going to happen. But yeah, sometime this year. Sometime this year, which is a miracle that they're able to actually do. And they release it in bits. It takes forever for the volume of data that they're looking at to verify everything, to clean everything. Because people don't know, you know, you're filling out on a form or whatever. You're like, I don't know how to answer that question. So that you got to go back through and clean every single, it's a huge effort.
So what's like the first thing Barna will do with census data when it comes out? Like what's the first thing?
Well, we will just download it whenever we need it. And so we'll go and look at, you just look at your demographic split. So with Gen Z, all right, we're going to go look at Gen Z data that we have. What sort of households do they live in? How many people live in those households?
Right.
So what can we learn about Gen Z from what's available? What sort of income, you know, levels of their parents do we notice? Obviously, ethnically, they're the most diverse generation. Literally, there is no majority anymore. When you get to like today's second graders and younger, there's no majority. So we're looking at that going, okay, what does that mean? Well, let's just think for a minute about the implications of that. We have some questions that we want to ask because of that. So we look at those sorts of stats and say, what's actually just kind of happening naturally in the population that would give us insights into how their lives are being shaped.
Who are two or three, I know I'm just rattling off questions here, but who are two or three think tanks that Barna would look at that seem to handle data pretty objectively? Are there two or three that come to mind?
I mean, Pew and Gallup are our favorites. I don't know if I call Gallup a think tank necessarily, but they do have certain areas of focus.
Brookings?
Sometimes if you're in the real estate business, for sure. And I used to use, back when I was in PR, I would use a lot of Brookings data because they do these social studies, right? And so when you're trying to understand physical populations, yeah, I like Brookings data. So we don't use them as much for Barna work, but I think that they're a great reliable resource for sure.
Right.
And then Rand Corporation, just for general trend tracking.
Rand Corp. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I haven't looked at it for a while, but does the Association of Religion Data Archives, do they still do
they
what they do?
They haven't done one in a while, and they kind of track right behind the census.
Isn't
so they're
that out
due
of
for
Penn
one.
State?
I think
it's out of Penn State.
It might have moved, but it was.
They've
had the last couple of years, they've had a couple of transitions on who's kind of taking responsibility for that. They're due out for one soon. I don't know what the status is.
I used to refer to them all the time.
Yeah.
Like 10 years ago.
Right, exactly. So we're waiting for the next one. Honestly, the data from 10 years ago is really not relevant right now. And so I haven't used it for a while. So whenever the next one comes out, because they're collecting data by church, right? And so that's a different way of capturing and reporting on that type of data. So
how do you package all of it? So we were talking about a project, and then we took a really deep dive on the tools of research and how you go about it. But how do you package all of that and then communicate it?
Yeah, that's a lot of work. That's very iterative. So we are spending all of our time really scrubbing, looking at every data, nitpicking everything. Does this make sense? What do we have questions about? Formulating kind of key stories and insights. Then we start to write, and that's where it becomes iterative. So at Barna, we actually have an editorial department that writes articles, and then we have the research department, and then we have kind of the publishing group that does all the design and things like that. The editorial department and research department work really closely together. So we'll kind of write our version of the analysis and the story we think is happening, and then they overlay, all right, now how do we kind of tell that for journalistically,
right,
from a perspective of like, what are the key things that someone would be interested in that would cause them to read this article? And they'll reshape it. And then we'll come back in and we'll say, okay, does this still feel accurate and representative? Is there anything that we need to double click on and add more data because they've identified something interesting here?
Right.
Do we think as a whole, this is still telling the right story? And then we could just kind of iterate from there. Not everyone has a journalism department. That's kind of a unique thing. If you're in typical market research, your researchers are writing reports. And basically that was the kind of role that I had where I wasn't really the stats quant jock. Like, right, I would work with those people to communicate about this is what the data says. And so it's all PowerPoint or, you know, some sort of report like that, where you're just kind of hitting bullets.
Right.
So that's a little more common, but Barna is much more journalistic in its style. And so it's a much more involved process.
Okay. So this is not the only thing you're doing. I mean, we were talking about even before the podcast, you really have like three big things that you're working on, or maybe two things and then one side thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you're doing Barna, mm-hmm, and you're senior vice president there. I want you to talk a little bit about True Motivate.
Yeah.
Like, what is that? What are you doing with them? But then you also have this podcast,
yeah,
on the side.
Yeah.
And you're just starting like season two.
Yes.
Can you talk about that? Maybe talk about that first.
I am going to talk about that first because it's more related to my Barna work.
Okay.
So basically, we started two studies about 2 years ago on looking at perceptions of race and justice issues in the U.S. and also looking at how that intersects with faith. And they're two related studies. They're both coming out within the next month or two. And I was so deep in the data about these issues that it really made me realize, and I was looking at what we were finding, it really made me realize, oh my goodness, the gap between Black and white Americans is pretty substantial, and we need to do a better job of listening to each other. And so that really just pricked my heart to say, you know what, I'm a researcher and I'm supposed to be objective, and I am, but I need to talk about this somewhere else,
right,
you know, rather than just report the data. Like, we need to process this together. How do we have better conversations? How do I take what I'm learning in this research about the experiences, particularly of Black Americans, but it could be of any people of color, and help white people who have not really engaged in this topic to maybe ask more questions, dig deeper, learn more, and move towards action in some way. So my podcast addresses that. It's called Race and Redemption.
And you partnered with somebody on that, right?
Yes. So my co-host is Susan Robinson. She's a friend who's been in ministry for a long time. And she is basically, she's the heart on the head, but we both have a pretty soft heart, I would say. But she brings a lot of like, these amazing connections with people of color in different spaces, tend to be ministry spaces, but like the arts and sports and things like that. So a lot of our guests are friends of hers, which is just super fun because she knows kind of these interesting personal sides of their lives. And then we'll pick a topic and say, well, let's unpack for our listeners what this means. So, you know, even for example, like how many people, you know, really know the detailed history of, very recent episode we just launched was about Chinese Americans in Mississippi and how Chinese and Black Americans had this shared experience of being marginalized in those communities and the whole Chinese Exclusion Act. Mm. Like that, we kind of connected with these documentarians and we're like, I don't think most people know this story. Let's share the story. And there's this incredible overlap of racial justice to two different ethnic groups in these towns in the South, based on the history of our country.
Right.
So we unpack a lot of the facts and the history there, but then we also talk about what does that mean for us today? And so that's kind of the premise of the podcast. So we bring in a lot of facts and data to kind of be the foundation. But a lot of it is so much of, let's just hear the story here and let's begin a conversation.
And you're in season two mm-hmm. at this point. And you're just mm-hmm. recording right now. You've not, these have not come out yet.
No, they've started coming out. Yeah, we're on maybe episode 3 or 4.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the name of the podcast again, I know you said it.
Yeah, Race and Redemption.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. So you're doing that in this True Motivate, which is sort mm-hmm. of new for you, right?
It Newer. Is. Yes. No, it is definitely new for me. So True Motivate is an assessment tool, just like you might take a personality assessment. It's similar to that. But whereas you might look at your strengths for Strength Finders or your personality with Myers-Briggs, this is looking at what motivates you. And one of the reasons I got involved is, as a researcher, I'm really bad at taking assessments because I overanalyze them. I know too much. So it's actually really hard to peg me down on a lot of assessments.
You know exactly where it's going with the questions exactly. that are being asked.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I know. And I'm like, well, I'm going to have to temper my answer there because I don't want to end up like one of those people.
You know, I've tried to, this is side note, but there's this one, so the Enneagram, I've tried to take that so many times and I've purposely answered differently thinking I'm going to come out different. And every single time I come out as a 5. Every single time.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
I cannot dodge the system.
How funny.
But that's like the only one that is like that. But I know where it's going when you get these things.
Yeah. So Enneagram is my big beef because there isn't science behind it. There's theory behind it. So as a data scientist, I'm kind of like, I already don't trust it. And then every time I've taken every variation of test, they can't pin me to a number. So I've been a 2, a 3. I'm a 5. I'm an 8, and most recently now I'm a 7. And I was like, well, how am I a 7? Like, anyway.
Okay, so that's... You just exposed the Enneagram now.
I know, I'm sorry for everyone who loves it. And I do see value in it, but it's not scientifically based, and so it's not super accurate. It's, you make of it when you, what you,
it's sort
you
know, of
pull
fun,
from
though.
It. Yeah,
it's sort of fun.
You pull insights from it. That's the goal. If you only use it for that, you're fine. But the moment you type yourself, you're like, oh, it's not really that accurate. Anyway, so True Motivate is probably the most accurate assessment I have ever taken or seen applied to anyone. So the science behind it is fantastic. And, you know, it was developed almost 60 years ago, theoretically. And then they kept refining and refining and refining the questions that got to it. And what's super cool is it's contextually grounded.
So who developed it first?
So Art Miller, who was basically an HR consultant, developed this thing. And he wrote a bunch of books. You can find, when you look for Arthur Miller, you find the playwright. But Art Miller was an HR consultant who talked about motivations. And it is so spot on.
Really?
I mean, probably 90% of the time when I debrief someone's results with them, they are just floored. Like, that is so accurate of me. Okay. And also, no one's ever gotten that so right before.
So now I want to take this assessment.
I know, it's so good. Here's why, which is what's super cool about it. Most assessments you take, like you said, you can answer with different things in mind. Am I thinking of me as a husband, as a dad, as, you know, a leader, as a friend, as a whatever? In my college years, now, like, you can't get the context right.
Right.
But this assessment tool has you tell 3 stories. And this is a common thing that HR consultants will do or coaches, you know, in the business world, right?
So it's not just circling the dots.
Right, exactly. It's well, I mean, there is that element, but you start with grounding
it. Or multiple choices, women say.
Yeah, no, you ground it first in your 3 stories. All right, now you pick these 3 experiences that you found, like really just areas of life that you loved, an experience that you loved or where you felt you were at your best. Now, answer these questions based on that story. So you've got an anchor, which gives it much more consistency in the data. But also, it's something meaningful to you. It's not what some researcher has said, based on the average person, this is something that's important. No, it's actually you and your context. So it's actually a really equitable tool, too. No matter what background you come from, you can tell a story about you and when you were at your best, and then answer questions based on that.
So who is using this? I mean, who has turned to this as kind of their assessment tool, but like employers, that sort of thing?
So it was used for a long time by a group called SEMA to do coaching at Fortune 100 companies. It's been used really broadly, tons of companies, but on an individual basis, and it was qualitatively applied. So basically, in the last couple of years, it's been kind of turned into a survey assessment tool that's online. And we are, Barna has a partnership with True Motivate to try to make this available for people kind of in ministries and churches. And then True Motivate is focusing primarily on colleges right now. So it's really designed, this particular tool is designed for college and young people to figure out their vocational direction. Like, I'm not sure what I want to do with my life, but I think I like this. So if you take a StrengthsFinder, it's like, you know, oh, looks like you're really good with, you know, analytics. So you probably should go into math. I can't tell you how many people I've done their, you know, their True Motivate. And they're like, yeah, they told me I should be a math major or a physics major or whatever. But actually, what I really love is philosophy. Like, okay, well, that wasn't coming out of your story.
Right.
But, in, you know, with True Motivate, you see those things and you're like, this isn't telling me that you're a mathematics kind of person. This is telling me you're a thinker and someone who loves to just explore and, you know. So it actually ties these 27 motivations, which are identified by the tool, with career paths that people could explore. So the main crux of it that I think is so interesting is the 27 motivations, and that's what really nails people. And you could apply that to all sorts of things. But then for young people, we have this component that ties it to different career paths for them.
So what are you doing with True Motivate?
Two different things. I'm trying to help it get launched into colleges, so helping them to see you know, how and where should we apply it. So for example, you might use it in your career development office to help people apply for jobs. But if you wait until they're a junior in college, like it's a right. little late to be figuring that out. They should really do that in their freshman year. So it's kind of working with admissions or enrollment or advisors to say, let's start this in their freshman year and like get them on the right pathway. So working to kind of develop programs and just kind of run that area of the business. And then with Barna, it's like, what content can we develop that goes with this that would help people use this in other contexts? So we've just been working with a leader who, he's a pastor, but he also does a lot of leadership development for youth. And he's written this whole like 5-week, you know, group study guide. And he weaves in concepts, like he's got this really awesome framework called Ikigai, if anyone wants to look it up. It's Ikigai. It's a Japanese concept that overlaps like your interests, your passions, what the world needs, and you know what people will pay you for.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And basically at the core of that is kind of like where your motivations show up. And so it's like, okay, so what are motivations? So it's understanding what that is. And then how do I use them? How do I discern what a motivation is versus what a passion is and what a skill set is? And so just putting all that in context and knowing how to use that.
Wow. Wow. Okay, we're getting close to the end of this podcast, but I want to ask, what does a day in the life of Brooke Hemphill look like? So what does it look like with you? What does it look like for someone who is really into research? So a day, a week, a year, what are some of the rhythms there?
Mm-hmm. Because I'm doing all those three things, my days look really scattered. I'm doing lots of things. I have lots of hats that I take on.
Are you more like you can concentrate on one thing? Like for one day, or can you like do all three things in
yeah,
one day?
I can do all three things. I'm really...
You just block it out in different times.
I'm really
segments?
Good. No, I multitask. I jump back and forth. And I have actually...
Like within the same 30 minutes?
Maybe about an hour at a time.
Okay.
I actually have read a number of books
about...
See,
I don't think Cal Newport would be very happy.
Most people will tell you, and I've read a number of books about this, that like that jumping around is not so great
he
for producing
you've
the best
3 or 4 hours of deep
of
work.
Of deep work.
Right?
So I
guess that could be a number of things.
Though. I have Deep Work Friday. So I'm here on my Deep Work Friday, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Deep Work Fridays are good for like solving big problems, but that's not the core of what I do.
Right. Okay.
Like I will carve out that time to go deep with a data set. Or my favorite is I have a few pictures of me, you know, after dinner at the end of the day, and I'll sit down with my laptop with a set of crosstabs open and just sit down for like 2 to 3 hours and just stare at the numbers and think when no one else is talking to me, like what am I seeing here? So I do have to make the time for that. But day to day, usually really a lot of it is just like process management, honestly, because the work that I do is so collaborative. So I'm working with statisticians. I'm working with people collecting the data, like we call them the field, the people actually doing those surveys, right? I'm working with the editorial team to write stuff. I'm working with the publishing team to set a timeline for when a study is going to come out. I'm working with the client to make sure we collaborate and get all their insights. So a lot of what I do, frankly, is project management, honestly.
Okay.
But you have to have that deep research knowledge to be able to bring it up to that level of putting together a project. So a lot of the beginning of my day tends to be just logistics and coordination and connecting with people. But what's interesting is I describe market research as going from the 30,000 foot view to the on the ground view back and forth all day long. And you have to do that. That's actually the point of it. So if you're a statistician, you'll stay on the ground and you'll be playing with the data and you'll be saying, here's what the numbers actually are.
Right.
And you pull up and then, you know, the next level is like, well, what are we learning about these numbers? And that's, you know, maybe some of the insights that are coming out of that. That's maybe the 10,000 foot view. And then you had to go up and up and up to the 30,000 foot view. Okay, 20,000 is like, what does this mean to this client and the work that they're doing? How do I apply these insights to their context, their marketplace, their situation? 30,000 foot view is what's going on in the world today and how does this connect with what's going on in the world today? So you have to kind of go up and down that plane ride all day long. And wow. So my day looks like that. It's like get on the ground, stare at numbers, get up to the top level. I'm reading trends. I'm reading articles that are giving me context of what's going on in the world right. And I'm piecing it together. So I actually am riding up and down that elevator all day long on purpose, because that's actually how market research is its best, is when it kind of helps to bridge the gap between the two.
Oh, wow. Is there something that changed during the pandemic? Just how you structured things?
The pace of things, which yeah. For many people is true. Actually, the main thing that changed is that people are even more comfortable than before with technology, and specifically video conferencing. And that actually has helped tremendously. Because really before, we would do some things virtual, you know, focus groups or whatever. And now it has to be all that. And it was a little bit more of a lift to get people, you know, kind of acclimated in a virtual focus group. And now it's like, yeah, I do this all day long. So here we are. I think that's actually helped, that people are more fluent in technology now, which makes it honestly easier to do a lot of the things
you
that
still
I do.
You still have a brick and mortar office here though in Atlanta,
we do.
Right? Okay.
We do.
Okay.
One of the things about collaborating with the research team is you can do things over Zoom, and I have a distributed team, so there's different offices we work with, but there is a huge value in getting together in a conference room, staring at a data set together, and then having a whiteboard next to you and really talking through, and you kind of get into that flow, you know, about 30, 40 minutes into a conversation, and like the light bulbs start going off.
Right.
And so that really still only happens in person.
Right.
We can try to replicate it digitally, but there is something about the in-person connection that makes it all start to connect. And it goes so much faster when you can do that.
No doubt. Mm-hmm. So what's next? What's next for you?
A lot of my focus is shifting more and more to True Motivate, and I'm super excited about it. What's been fun is that as we've rolled it out, people have come across it and they're like, oh, wow, that could be really useful for helping people in relationships. Oh, this could be really useful for helping people in a mentoring relationship. In fact, what if I even helped match mentors and mentees together based on having similar motivations, and then they can really connect and build a rapport faster, and it gives them something to talk about. And so we're actually working with a number of different organizations to kind of build different versions.
Okay.
Of this motivational assessment that could apply in different contexts. So that's kind of my next thing is like, oh, what else can I do with this? So I'm often building and establishing things. One of my motivations is established. So I like to build things, not just build new things, but like root things in, give them the foundation they need so that they'll grow. And then once I've kind of got them established, think of a little plant. Once the seedling is strong enough to be planted outside, okay, right. Now I can go do the next thing. So that's kind of my space that I'm playing with.
So this would be the last question. It's been so fun having you on the show today. I'm just curious, if you could go back to when you were at Cornell and what you were studying at Cornell, knowing what you know now, knowing what you're doing now, is there something that you would have studied differently, something that you would have done differently?
Yeah.
With your undergrad?
I have wondered this.
Or maybe during that season of your life.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's maybe some things I might have wanted to pay more attention to. I probably would have done a few more demographics or statistics classes and paid more attention in them, because I took them most of them my freshman and sophomore year. So
yeah, you're not paying any attention.
You're just like, it's the fire hose. You're like, right. Okay, tell me that again.
Right.
So maybe that. But honestly, I have really thought about this question a lot. I don't think that I would have the perspective I have now had I not gone through those zigs and zags in my career and experienced things that were not quite on the right path, but gave me an understanding of what that pathway was. So I really piece it all together. Did I need to do the hospitality business? No. But the business school the program that I went to was, you know, just like any business school education. So it was phenomenal. And it was a great grounding for doing what I'm doing today. It just had a few extra courses like, you know, cooking and hotel engineering that weren't necessary. One of the things we talk about with True Motivate, because you're advising students on their career path, is resilience. Mm-hmm. And I try to help people understand what you're trying to do is understanding the breadth of who you are and the ways that you might use that, because the industry changed, the world changes, like the dot-com era changed everything. So if I had learned something that was on a particular path and then the pathway changed, now what do I do? So what you're trying to do is build enough of a diversity of skill sets that you can adapt as the marketplace adapts. And so I actually appreciated all the experiences I had because they gave me skill sets that I could apply in different contexts. So PR gave me writing skills. You know, the heavy stats company gave me fluency with numbers. And then, you know, being able to then translate that into the broader sorts of publications we do now, you know, that's just piecing all those things together, that if I had done any one of those things, I wouldn't have had that skill set. You needed all of them. So really think of it as a portfolio, mm-hmm. as opposed to a pathway. I think that's important to build resilience. One of the most common questions that career service offices are dealing with now is what happens when AI changes my job.
Yeah, no doubt.
Right? And I get replaced and there's no need for me anymore, my skill set that I've trained for. And that is a real consideration, a real issue. So
yeah, it is.
Having a really open mind about beginning to build a skill set and considering yourself a lifelong learner. What's the thing I'm learning in this 5-year period? And what's the thing I'm learning in this 5-year period? You know, as opposed to saying, this is my pathway, I'm going to get my PhD in this, and I'm going to be deep. You could do that. But in order to deal with the curveballs that come at you from the market, you need to be prepared to keep going back and learning new things. How am I skilling up in this area on a constant basis?
Yeah. Wow. So cool. Brooke, thank you for coming by. This
Thanks.
Has been fun.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Find us on Instagram at VG Voyager and join the conversation for today's episode.
And that concludes season 1 of Voyager, a Vaughn Group podcast. Thank you so much for joining us for these 8 episodes. And we're already working on season 2. So make sure you stay tuned to our social media for the launch date of that. We've got some really good guests coming up. And thank you again for listening and subscribing.
This episode of the podcast has been brought to you by Core Media. Editing and mixing by Kevin Duthu. Recording and studio coordination by Beth Grabencourt. Camera and video editing by Will Gehring. Project management by Origami. Music featured in season 1 is entitled To Sleep Perchance by Teague from the album As Ice Would Do and is available wherever music is found.
This has been Voyager, a Vaughn Group podcast highlighting innovative leaders who get stuff done. Join us every Wednesday to journey through the lives and minds of creative visionaries, artists, and innovators who are changing the world with their work.